We're on. Well, good morning, everybody. We're delighted to be starting our second day here. And as you can see from the schedule, there's a lot of free time. There was plenty of time this morning. We got about 45, 50 minutes of answering questions and then a big break. And during that time, they'll be showing Chuck Chamberlain a DVD here. Or you can wander, whatever. None of this is mandatory or anything, so I hope you enjoy that. Now, when you get down to questions and answers, you learn a lot of things if you are around sessions like this. I love the Brentwood group out in California. They have a beginner's thing where you talk for 20, 30 minutes, and then they stand up and ask questions of old timers, and Chuck C. used to go there, and you'd be able to ask him a question. If we did this next week, this same box of questions, you might hear different answers from me than you hear today. And if you had your sponsor come up and do it, you might hear different answers. A lot of them are going to seem the same. But you got to realize that the answer that I'm going to give is going to come from my perception of it today. Part of the fun of question and answers, and today I'm going to take about 10 or 15 seconds after I read the question, is for you to sort of go, okay, and then you hear another perspective on it. And when you combine the two, you really get to see something even beyond that. And that's the fun. That's why that book, I Am That, has always intrigued me, because the awakened person in India, and people come to ask him questions, spiritual seekers from all over the world. So you get to read the question for that this stupid guy from England asked. And then you go, God, I could answer that. And so you form the answer. Then you read, and you go, oh, okay. Well, wow. Never would have seen it that way. So that's why I think it's fun to have these sessions. So we'll start out randomly. We could do the Karnak. You remember Karnak? Goodyear tires. What was Mrs. Goodyear's biggest complaint? Okay. Boy, these are going to be funny answers. Where does letting go of a resentment for my sanity end and being like a doormat start? And how do I know the difference to choose the right action? Today I feel the answer is you have to work with your sponsor and with the program to stop feeling like a doormat. Otherwise, everything that you do is going to make you feel like a doormat. In other words, there's an underlying problem. It's almost like you have to stop drinking first in order for something to happen. So if the center of you feels like a doormat, every act of forgiveness is going to reinforce your feeling, or every act of getting rid of a resentment is going to feel like you're just adding to the doormat feeling. So you that's why you're afraid, you feel already ahead of time, if I do that, I'll feel like a doormat. And that's not who we are. So that's, whoever it is, I would just say that is, just get down with your sponsor and go, what is this doormat thing? And it's extreme self-centeredness. In other words, everything revolves around me. Every action that people take is to make me feel less than I am, that whole thing. So I would say that's, you really can't accomplish anything till you can move off the center of being a doormat. Okay. What's in a spiritual toolbox? Well, that's a great question. I bet if we went around the room, we'd get all kinds of different answers. What's in a spiritual toolbox? Okay, I'll give you a two-word answer. Power tools. They have to be plugged in. Do you see what, in other words, they're plugged into God, that gives them the power to work. So when we pick up this simple kit of tools, you got to remember that the purpose is they're plugged in. Now you go about whatever you're doing, whether it's taking an inventory, whether it's sharing, you want to be plugged into God. You might just always, that's why we start the prayers, let me be of your service and turn my life over. And it's connected there. Now the tools can be properly used and we'll get the results they're supposed to get. And we forget that. The ego wants us to forget that. And it just says, well, I guess I got to get over that resentment. I'll just forgive him. I'll do that. And I'll surrender and all that. It's got to be plugged in. So that's my... Now, if you want to know what is specifically in there, I would put at the top of the list the main tool, the main course of action of all of Alcoholics Anonymous, letting go. What are you working on? Well, I'm all upset about it. Get, throw it away, let go. Come back tomorrow, see what's been done with it. But no, you cannot be helped with anything till you let it go. Top of the list of the tools of AA. What do you think of long-distance sponsorship? I've heard great reports. You got to realize these are individual decisions. I personally don't do it. I have to see the people. That's just me. I want to see their eyes at meetings. I don't sponsor people unless they're going to at least one or two meetings that I go to every week. Now, if an old timer in Chicago wants to call me and say, can I call you once in a while and get your feedback on something? I go, great, yes. But it's not a sponsorship relationship. I just somehow have put that in my head. That means I see you so that I can ask you what's the matter. And on the phone sometimes I can't see your face. And so, but, I mean, Clancy must have pigeons all over the world. And I'm sure some of you old timers in here, yeah, I sponsor a guy in here and there. I'm just telling you for myself, I'll be glad to have people ask questions and answer them, but I don't. Somebody called me from Washington, D.C. and said, could you be my sponsor? I'd say no, but you can call me with questions. So that's my take on that, which is just one of many. I was going to wait to ask this, but is procrastination a form of self-centeredness? Boy, that's a fascinating question. I've never even thought about procrastination. I guess I like the two-syllable word, lazy. Yes, of course. And I believe that the self-centered part of it is being a perfectionist. And we just don't want to do anything until we're going to do it perfectly. And since we can't do that and we're never really ready to, And I would also say fear. I just don't want to take a risk. I don't want to take step out of my comfort zone. I know I'm funny. I know I got a bunch of jokes, but I'm not going to stand up at a comedy theater and find out. And so I delay it. And it's a way of working against your own best interest, which of course is one of our specialties, is to take courses of action that aren't going to work good for us in case we were running out of things to worry about. So this gives us a way of adding. As you clean up the past, you go, hell, what am I going to stay up all night over? I know. So you create some new messes that you can sit and think about. And when you really get used to making fun of yourself, which is inventory, this thing becomes a game. I can't believe you're up to that. I mean, you're talking back and forth. You're trying to set me up to do this. Well, you fell for it last month. Oh, this is on the inside. This is the best question in the box. It's on humility, oddly enough. Okay, Sandy, what single event or circumstances triggered your desire to connect with this force at such a deeper level? Well, that is a good question. What single event or circumstance? I've just had some things happen, probably around 30 years, somewhere in there. I was always on this path, but then I had things happen just to me, and I've had amazing experiences with trees, just seeing energy out of trees that just took my breath away, and certain places that I've been where suddenly that location was just overpowering, filled with different colors, and it was just amazing. And I normally don't talk about this very much, but one time I was going on a trip, and I was packing and shaving, and I looked in the mirror, and my face was a mask. It was very cleverly put on there. And I could tell it was me, and I must have looked about 8 times. It didn't bother me, it didn't shake me up. But I knew my eyes were the eyes of the spiritual being having a human experience. And it stayed there the whole morning. And after a while, I just said, oh, that's interesting. This is, so I got went to the airport and I got checked in, and then I was sitting around, and everybody in the airport had the same thing. And I found myself staring at him, and then I saw him staring back at me, and I said, oh, you got to stop doing that. And then it went away. And I've been awakened in the night, and just with overwhelming senses of well-being, just, oh my God, I don't even want to go back to sleep. And so I think it was somewhere around, I had more progress between ages 37 to 40 years than I had in the first 37 years. Just happening. So it's probably the result of doing the legwork, and then it showed up. And so your 12 and 12 talks about that this all spiritual awakenings is a gift from God. But we have to prepare ourselves to receive it. Otherwise, it can't be delivered. And I remember many years ago using the analogy of moving out in the country And out there, you have to set up a, remember, a post box on a post. It has to be on a certain side of the road. And if you got mail, you put the flag up. And if, it has to be a certain size and all of that, or you don't get mail. And so the practicing alcoholic said, I can't, that's too much freaking work. Just throw it on the yard. And the post office said, we're not going to take this guy's mail and throw it on the yard. So they don't throw it on the yard. And as the months go by, he says, nobody's writing me anymore. His sense was, there is no mail coming. And we can have the sense there is no God, because we haven't done the work so that it can be delivered. So all the presence, the spiritual, not presence C, but presence like Christmas presents that are waiting cannot be delivered yet. The delivery place has to be prepared. And that's what I think happened, was that so you must just keep going and look at the great line in the promises. They will always materialize if we work for them, which means if we prepare ourselves for them, always materialize. And that's what a beautiful spiritual word. Materialize? What, out of thin air? Yes, out of thin air. So anyway, that's what, oh, and you know, and meeting Chuck Chamberlain, I mean, I could name, but those are the, when it was the things that happened to me personally that just took away all doubt that this whole fourth dimension of existence is real. God, I'm having a hard time. I hate. I just can't read this. Oh, I have something, a progressive illness, and I'm concerned about medications. Okay, so we don't have to know exactly what that is. And my emotional sobriety. My ability to concentrate is declining, and I may need to take stimulant medication in order to be able to further function well at work. I'm also struggling with the idea of being disordered. It is okay on a partial disability to take the insurance my company provides for this. How does this fit in with the seventh tradition? I'm not sure I understand the whole thing. If you don't mind, whoever wrote this, could we talk together afterwards? And let me just have you flesh this out a little bit. If it's about medications, there are times when we have to take medications. We have to take pain medications. We have illnesses. And the medications could easily interfere with our connection with other people and with God and all that. And it's sometimes we have to do it. It's just, but if it's done with your friends around you, if it's done with doctors who understand addiction, etc. But I don't know if that's the thrust of that. So if it's all right, whoever wrote that, we'll find 10 minutes and sit together. Okay? What is the process of forgiveness? How do we forgive and receive the peace of forgiveness instead of stuffing of resentment? I was going to work this in, so I'm glad it came up. I mean, I've had a lot of breakthroughs on this because, you know, last year I had one daughter murdered and one daughter died of alcoholism. So there's a opportunity there for forgiveness. And some of the lessons I learned out of it, I would decide this weekend that you are now a forgiving person. And if the most outrageous, unfair thing at work happened, where they picked some other guy totally unqualified, kicked your butt out, didn't give you the money they promised you, and job prospects really suck, you're going to forgive them. You're just going to decide now that you are a forgiving person. It will prepare you for when these type of events happen, if you have decided ahead of time. Because that's what I did. I saw people forgiving outrageous things years before, and I went, how did they do that? I couldn't even conceive of doing that. Forgiving somebody who murdered your son the very same day you're forgiving him? What is that all about? But I saw the peace on this woman's face, and I just raised my sights. Do you follow what I'm saying? I'm going to take my forgiveness up to here. I didn't know you could take it up there. And so you can picture the most, whatever you feel could never be forgiven, and decide today to forgive that in case it ever happens. And you're going to see the small stuff that comes up is going to be so easy. So, there's a saying, to err is human, to forgive is divine. All humans screw up and make mistakes and do mean things and do unconscionable things. That's the nature of being a human. And if we went back to our record, there are things in my fifth step that I ain't talking about here. Do you follow what I'm saying? Who hasn't done something really outrageous or thought about it or whatever? So if that's the nature of human beings, then the God part of us is where the forgiveness is. So in order to forgive, we move up one level with inside ourselves. Here's the ego. Don't screw with me. That's unfair, operating down here. And when something happens to that part of us, I'm going to get you. But what happens to this part of us, it's totally understanding, forgiving, and you can let go of it. The other thing is, and this is very important, when you receive the disturbing news, whether it's your brother was killed in an automobile accident, let's say you got a phone call, Larry, Joe was just killed, drunk driver, killed him dead, and you got the phone in your hand, you all know there's about a quarter, half second before you react to it. Do you relate? Sometimes you go sit down before you let it sink in. It isn't automatic. There is that time. Use that time before you react to it to turn to God and say, God, before I react to this, I just want to assure you this is not going to change how I feel about you. Do you see how important that is? This awful thing I'm about to react to would never change how I feel about you. You're more important than everything. My relationship with you is the top up here, and I want to just let you know how much I love you and how I am going to stay connected to you. Thank you. Now I'm going to go sit down and guess who comes with you? Guess who you just invited in to sit with you as you let it all in? And you just feel the comfort protecting you as you feel the sorrow. And you don't feel angry at the driver. You don't have hatred. You don't have resentment. You just have sorrow. And sorrow God can help you with. Hatred, you're on your own. Go ahead. You want to hate? Go ahead. If you'd like to get rid of it and forgive, fine. Then God will step in. So we sentence ourselves to three times the pain that we're supposed to feel, which is from sorrow. We're just supposed to feel sorrow. So the involvement of God is crucial, because most times the lower level part of us will be mad at God. How could God let my brother die? So now we've cut God off, we're mad at him, and now we're mad at the driver. And you can see the house of cards that's going to fall on our heads. So that's some thoughts on forgiveness. It's the high level, and it's not talked about enough in AA. It's in St. Francis prayer, and it's in, when we're going to make amends, let's start out by forgiving them one and all. But it's not a big topic that we should spend. And so here we can have an environment and get spiritual literature and start conceptualizing. But I would say, if you just said, I am now going to move up to this level, the spirit level, and just say, I am going to forgive. That's me. I am the forgiver. And watch how your next year goes. Glad that question came up. Oh boy, these are something. In chapter 11, the 12 and 12, it has the prayer of St. Francis. The last line is, it is by dying that one awakens to eternal life, or in the Sandy Beach version, life eternal. Well, St. Francis had it screwed up. He did. There's no doubt. Couldn't resist. I probably do say it wrong. Can you please give us your interpretation of that line? Well, of course, when you were new, we go, holy cow, I have to be murdered in order to awaken to life eternal. St. Francis realized, he has a very interesting life, and if you get a chance to read any of the biographies of him, he's just, what a character. And he ended up seeing that his ego was standing between him and God. And he just set out on a course of action of unselfishness and ego diminishing that was rather extreme in terms of self-sacrifice, giving your clothes to other people, devoting all your attention, begging in the streets to get money to give to others. And as he progressed in this direction of removing the ego, which is what the dying process here is talking about, is the death of the ego, the death of the part of us that is separate from God. He got as close as probably most people could ever get. And when he did, the energy coming out of him was so powerful that people just like to stand around and be in his presence. And I've heard people say that about the Dalai Lama and some other people, that just being able to be near the energy, and you feel the energy in AA, you feel certain, you can feel spiritual energy. And of course, he's portrayed with the animals are coming out of the woods just wanting to stand there, and birds sitting on his shoulder and all this. So he wrote the prayer as his recollection of the steps that allow this process to kill the ego. So it is by dying unto God that you will be connected to life eternal, and you will realize that you never die. Do you see what I'm saying? You will, by totally moving, we just talked about forgiveness and moving from the gut level up to the spiritual level. So as we move up here, the old ideas about forgiveness die. They're gone. So that piece of the ego is gone. So we just entered into a dying. It's by dying out the old ideas about forgiveness. It is by killing this, getting rid of that, Hal Marley used to always talk about. The topic was, at a discussion meeting, was killing the ego. And so they're going around the room, well, this way, and I try to get rid of that and this and that. And some guy comes in late and he turns to a newcomer and he says, "What's the topic?" And the newcomer said, "Suicide." Because when we're all ego, it looks like suicide. It looks like everything there is going to be gone. But as you make spiritual progress and you can see your spiritual entity becoming bigger and you're more in touch with it, then we understand that if this part, the more it dies, the more we're connected to life eternal. So that's what he's talking about. Oh. This must be good. Does it hurt you to bend over anymore? Oh. Wow. We worked that out ahead of time. Your description of the illusion of each individual having a story that makes him or her separate from the rest of the universe is very similar to a basic core teaching of Buddhism. They call the removal of that illusion non-duality. Can you comment on that? Couldn't agree more. Couldn't agree more. That is precisely the same thing. Absolutely. And once duality is gone, you have solved the mystery of life. There's nothing left to do but exist and enjoy God and the universe, which is the way I believe it was set up. I'll talk about it on Sunday morning, but that's the way I believe it was set up, was this wondrous world and universe was put together for us to enjoy, and we're so damn busy with a hangnail that we missed the show. We just missed the show. I'll watch it as soon as I get rid of this. There isn't a bigger show than this one. So anyway, yes, that's perfect. There's no difference at all. How do you handle someone with time, 5+ years? That's not time. Anyway. You remember Clancy, when he had 20 years, he wouldn't let somebody with 15 years get his coffee. And then when he had 40 years, he wouldn't let somebody with 15 years in the room. Okay, so I understand. How do we have somebody who has time, who ought to know better, who wants you to sponsor them and take them through the steps? Again. I would say you would have to be comfortable with that. It's not that it's right or wrong. It's that if you feel that this is meant to be and that you'll enjoy it and you can see that it would be helpful, then you can get over the awkwardness of someone who has more time than you wanting you to help them. But if you're uncomfortable with it, it's probably not going to work out too good. So pray about it and think about it, but I don't think it fits in a wrong or right category at all. I think this is case by case. Sometimes it'll be a good idea, and sometimes it won't. Somebody who's been around a long, long time and their sponsor suddenly disappears, they almost always have to find somebody to bounce things off of that has less time because there isn't anybody left. Good question. Okay. What part of the retreat is tax deductible? Did you write that? No. Oh, that's great. I can't even think of a great answer. Although I haven't paid for this t-shirt yet. I hope that's not a serious question. How can I seek? I love simple questions like that. How can I seek? We forget, there's a word that has so much power, and we forget how powerful it is, and it's in the third step. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God. That's how you seek. You make a decision to become a seeker. You know what I mean? Just think when you were going to, maybe you wanted to become a CPA. You say, you know, I'd like to become a CPA. I'm going to do that. You know, you talk it with your friend. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to become a CPA. I'm going to do that. So far, nothing has happened. We know what CPA stands for. And there's a school down the street. They actually have classes. Nothing has happened. And one night you say, and you make a decision to get a CPA. And you pick up the phone and you call, I'd like to register at your school. What do I fill out? The decision starts the ball on going. So if you decide, just like I said, decide today to be a high-level forgiveness person. You decide to seek, and it'll all happen. You'll suddenly pick up a book back there that really talks to you. You'll suddenly find yourself looking in the paper in your hometown. Somebody's coming to give a talk on meditation. Oh, yeah, a seeker would go to that. I'm a seeker. You make this decision, and the whole world opens up that was there all along before you made the decision. So I would say that's the crucial, crucial thing, is decide, and things will just start unfolding. Well, here's another question on the last line of St. Francis. It's by dying that one awakens to eternal life. Is there really life after death? Okay, the answer to that has to be experienced. And I'm not joking. You have to engage in the spiritual seeking, the meditation, the contemplation, the prayer, and see if that answer is revealed to you. And when it is, that'll be the end of that. And you will know for sure that there is this fourth dimension of existence. But you won't be able to prove it to anybody else. Do you follow what I'm saying? This is not something where you just, I read something up here and then everybody in the room goes, oh yeah, I see. It's not an intellectual thing. It is, would you like to find out? Here's how you can find out for yourself. And when it's revealed to you, you will just go, oh yeah, I am now absolutely sure of that. But nobody could convince you. You father, see the difference? It's you have to seek, and when it's time, it'll be revealed. And then you'll just know. It'll just be there. Okay? Besides staying sober, being a responsible home group member, what can I do to help our service structure stay viable? That's a really complicated question for me to answer. Most people in AA don't see this as even a problem. because they're busy in their home group, they're busy sobering up people, they're busy doing things and all of that. So here's my answer if you are trying to work on this. And it's not that good an answer, but it's the best damn answer I can come up with. If you are on a spiritual path and you're being tugged to get off it by the ego or whatever we want to call this, and we're going to live and stay, the more you go down the spiritual path, the narrower it gets. What used to be acceptable when you had 1 year of sobriety, so I take a few government pens and bring them home, and I, you know, what the hell, this is lying around, doesn't count. You're going to find after 5 years, I think I'll leave the government pens there. You see what I mean? You're narrowing what's acceptable for you personally. But the instinctual drives are still operating. And maybe you're at work and you, did I talk about this earlier? And you decide to go over and just flirt a little bit with the secretary, just for the fun of it. Even your wife would see it's just kidding. And you just have this little joke and then you stop. You would call that a half of a degree course correction. I just slid this tiny, tiny much off of the spiritual path. And you know what happens. It just, as time goes on, you're further out here. Just by making the tiniest little exception in what would be what we know should be done. And as we allow that to happen, then we become more flexible in allowing other things to happen. And suddenly, we're engaged in things, and finally our sponsor goes, stop this, stop that, stop this, get back, all right, boom, and we're back. So you can see the tiniest little thing will cause us to get off the spiritual course. If that can happen to a human being, it can happen to an AA group. It could just happen with the tiniest little thing. If I'm just making something up. An old timer says, look, my mother's going to be in town for 2 months. She's not an alcoholic. She's an old lady. Could she come to our closed meeting? And we go, what harm could that do? You follow what I'm saying? So it's closed meeting with an exception. So then somebody comes who's a gambler and says, well, you let an old lady in. Why can't a gambler come? Well, if a gambler can come, why can't this guy come? You know what I mean? You just went, and then off we went. There's other ways that a group can get off a spiritual path and become something else. An intellectual discussion group, whatever the hell you want to call it. So if a group can do that, so could AA itself. It could just sit and go, we need more members. I'm just making something up. We need more members. Our membership isn't growing fast. We're shrinking a little bit. What can we do to increase membership? Well, we could not frighten people away with telling, you know, they think AA is too religious. We could make it look more philosophical than it is. We could do this, we could do that. Maybe good motives, whatever. So what I'm proposing is we need a navigation aid that'll keep us on course as individuals, groups, and the fellowship as a whole, and I would say that it's very simple. One problem, one solution. Alcoholism, God. That's it. So I'm an alcoholic, and I have a perfect solution to find God, and that's the end of the ball game. And if we are trying to navigate to accommodate anything else, we've started leaving, and who knows where it'll take us. That's enough on that. I could talk for several hours. What are your thoughts about evil? Oh, I love evil. I was giving a talk on forgiveness at the Tampa Fall Roundup. I don't know why this reminded me of it. I'm going to be serious about this question, but it was on forgiveness. And I pulled a question out, and it said, "What about Hitler?" And I thought about it, and I realized that's the exact question I would have written if some guy was up there preaching forgiveness. I was going to show him, "What about Hitler?" And so I said, "Ah, the loophole question." We got to find a loophole in this forgiveness thing, and Hitler's probably a good way to create a loophole. Once we create a loophole that you don't forgive Hitler, then I won't have to forgive my brother-in-law. So, so I said, "I forgive Hitler." So that closed that. So I don't know, evil makes me think of Hitler. So what are your thoughts about evil? Do you believe evil exists? What does one do about it? Okay, so here you can see I'm going to deviate from religions quite a bit, and I don't believe it exists. And I'm sure you're going, "Well, you're wrong." I probably am, but let me tell you what I think. I don't believe that darkness exists. Darkness cannot come into this room while the lights are on, and we won't be able to see each other. The lights have to go out for darkness to exist. So darkness is not an entity unto itself, it's merely the absence of light. There's only light, or the absence of light. There's no force called darkness that can come in and overpower light. Do you see what I mean? So that there's only one thing, light, or the absence. So there's only one thing, love, or the absence of love. And in the absence, we have this label that we could call evil. And so it is, we get so far away from God that we think we've encountered evil, when in reality, it's simply there's no connection left, and there's nothing but self-centeredness and the instinctual drives running the whole show, and it looks like evil took over. But as we turn around and come back, we start seeing evil, whatever we would call that, losing its power, until it just doesn't exist. But somehow you have to explain all the horrible things that happen, and I could see where that's a good way of saying, well, there's evil and it goes around the world and it does all these things. But in my own life, which is the only reference point I have, I really don't see evil knocking on my door and saying, "I'm here, you're through." It is all connected to conscious contact and conscious separation. And conscious separation will create something that you could call evil, which is removed when you have conscious contact. So that's, and I hope the churches will forgive me. What is self-consciousness? Well, I don't know what it's going to say in the dictionary, but we have different ways. One is an inordinate awareness of ourself, so that as we proceed along, we're just measuring how people are reacting to us. And their reaction causes us all kinds of adverse feelings and we struggle to cause behaviors in others so that we get approval and all of that. I'm just so self-conscious. I'm so aware that of me and my feelings everywhere I go. Now, the other thing would be the conscious, if we could become conscious of our true selves, then that would be a huge positive thing. That is really the point. As we discover God, we discover our true selves, and they're all merge into one. So I see two sides to that. Are we near the end? We're at the end. I just got the flag from the back. We are now calling this session to an end, and thank you all for your attention and great questions.